From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the third day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, Iowa farmers have testified before the House Agriculture Committee that the ACRE program is not enticing enough for them to use. The scientific review of atrazine, scheduled to end later this year, looks like it'll stretch into 2011. And the CEO of RCAF USA says the federal government is finally probing his members in a manner that suggests the agency wants to know if packers are colluding to hold down the price of beef. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in the half hour. In the second half hour of our program, on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with the president-elect of the ASA. That's the American Soybean Association. And don't forget, in 26 minutes, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast. And along the way today, we'll hear the first in a four-part series I call The Story of Corn. It all happens on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled up in Chicago. On this Monday afternoon, futures in the soft red winter wheat pits settled at 490, a penny and three quarters lower in the May. July at 501 and three quarters, down one and one quarter. July Kansas City hard red at 513, a penny and three quarters. Back in Chicago, lower that is, back in Chicago, the May futures there in the corn pit at 362 and three quarters, down 3.5 cents. July at 371 and a half, three and three quarters lower. September, 380 and a quarter, down 3 1/4. December, 389 and a half, down 2 3/4. In the March contract, $4 a penny and 3/4, down 3 1/4 in the corn pit. From the soy complex, May beans, $9.75 and 3/4, a loss today, down 13 3/4 cents. July at 986 and a half, 12 and a half lower. August soybeans, 985 and a half, down 12. September at 972 and a half, 11 and a quarter lower. And November beans at 966 and a half, down 9 1/4. May bean meal at 282.70, down 860. The oil in the July contract at 39.01, up 8 for the day. June live cattle futures down 95.52 and a half, $1.30 higher. May feeders at 113.40, up 60. And the lean hog futures at 89.82 and a half finished the day 30 cents higher. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Outside markets at this hour look like this. Crude oil futures, July contract 89.14, up 78 cents. Ethanol at $1.59 7 cents, down 0.5 cent. Natural gas at $4.03, up 8 3/10. Heating oil or diesel fuel 3 1/10 cents higher at $2.34 7 cents. And the gold futures today at $1,182.70, up $2.60. The Dow now at 11,174, 166 points higher for the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs at 552.99 is up 3.05. The weather forecast kind of rocky for the afternoon. A storm prediction center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of central Illinois and much of Indiana in our severe weather coverage area. This includes the counties of Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties, at all until 8 p.m. this evening. Here's what the weather forecast does look like. It's from our own Ed Keezer. He says tonight in the northwestern part of Illinois, it'll clear off. Elsewhere, partly to mostly cloudy, some scattered showers and thunderstorms. Lows ranging from 42 in northwestern Illinois to 55 in the southeastern part of Indiana. Scattered showers and a few thunderstorms will cross Illinois and Indiana this afternoon and tonight. Some rain totals may reach an inch in the vicinity of those thunderstorms, but generally amounts will be less than half an inch. Much warmer temps and southerly winds will bring improving field conditions before the next rain on Thursday and Friday. The late weather week weather system in the week could bring heavier precipitation to the northern sections of Illinois and Indiana, resulting in some more delays in those regions. More on the ag weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to The Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. On a Monday afternoon, Kurt Kimmel is away, but there in Bates Commodities, Pete Manhart is with us in the normal Illinois office. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the marketplace. Kind of an interesting day, I suppose. Were you able to make heads or tails out of it?
Not really, but, I mean, the planting pace is good, so that kept things from going much higher. No China news of more buys. Kept a lid on the corn, and I think that helped keep everything else down. Greece situation, I think, helped the dollar. They're going to help them, but they don't know for sure how, and blah, blah, blah. And the dollar being higher helped push grains down. But really, in reality, it's still a up time of year while we're planting, and I don't know that anybody really knows where it's going over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
The oil seeds, soybeans in particular, managed to stage a pretty good loss on the afternoon. What happened there?
I think they had been drug up there by the corn and the wheat. We also, the early planting pace on corn maybe had industry thinking that we wouldn't plant as many acres. We had had still good buying from China over the last month, but I mean this week none of the amount that we shipped last week was to China, so I think they've pretty well switched to South America for their bean supply, and that will be negative for the beans. If you look at where we closed today, we're still more than 60 cents off the low of a month ago.
What are the expectations for this afternoon's crop progress reports?
In corn, they're looking at somewhere between 60 and 68% planted nationwide, and in beans, somewhere between 10 and 15. I don't know where they got last week's, but we here thought that last week they would be higher than they were. So there's a lot of people out there thinking in the 70s on corn.
And they think beans have farmers been out of the field in part because of the weather and in second part because they simply aren't ready to go in or were waiting patiently?
That's very true on the beans, especially because of the time of year. And, planting beans early, you can get them frosted off by middle of May. So there are people waiting to plant beans. Before this last weekend, there were still some dry areas where they were waiting for moisture, but I think most of those this weekend finally did get rain.
What do you make of the livestock sector at this time?
Livestock sector is, I think, still got an upside to it. Cattle were up over a buck. Hogs were up as much as a buck in some months, and I think they're looking at exports being better, and they're looking at world economy being better, so that more people will eat more beef and pork.
And you think the livestock sector will respond by increasing the size of the herds?
Oh, I think that will happen. It takes a while to increase beef. It doesn't take as long on the hogs. But I think we're still looking at $90 hogs as a goal. We're only a dollar away on the front month, May, and we're looking at feeders back. They were over 116, 116.50 today. I think there's still people looking at those going three to four higher, and the cattle going, pushing $100 again.
Pete, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois, joining us from his offices there, filling in this afternoon for his compadre, and that's Kurt Kimmel, of course. You are listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And if you'd like to hear what Pete had to say again, you can always do that on our website. The address there is willag.org, willag.org. There you'll find all our daily agricultural programming, including the closing and opening market reports, the pre-opening market report, too, and a midday update. That happens with Sue Martin. It's all available for free online at willag.org. If you can't listen to us on the radio, you can't hear us on the web, how about dialing this number, 217-333-3430. 34. Again, the number 217-333-3434. We update that voicemail at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily with a bit of analysis and, of course, either the opening or the closing market report numbers.
The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
In a moment, Dave Dickey will be here. He's the Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media, and he'll have an update of all the agricultural news. Dave is also the author, that is, of our weekend newsletter. It's an awfully good one, all about the markets and what happened during the week. You can subscribe to it, of course, online at willag.org. Over on the right-hand side of the page, you can manage your subscription there, too. It's just as easy to get on the list as it is to get off of that list. All on the right-hand side of the page. Just sign up, and if you give us your cell phone number, we'll text you updates when the USDA releases its important reports. Now here's Dave.
In agricultural news, farmers in Iowa told congressmen that changes are needed in the Farm Safety Net's new revenue program as lawmakers cautioned about the fiscal challenges they will face trying to write the next farm bill. On Friday, six members of the committee listened to testimony all afternoon at an Iowa field hearing. One theme running through the first panel of farmers who testified is that the crop producers don't see a benefit in signing up for the average crop revenue election program created in the 2008 Farm Bill. House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson says that Congress made ACRE too complicated and that the only reason the program made it into the Farm Bill was an estimated cost savings of roughly $1 billion over the life of the bill. Peterson says he thinks ACRE could be retooled and may work better with county triggers instead of state triggers. It's now looking more likely that the scientific review of atrazine, originally expected to be completed by year's end, will most likely stretch into 2011. EPA officials announced that the results of the agricultural health study, which tracks those who use, apply, or may be exposed to a variety of pesticides, will not be finished as expected. Initially, the EPA planned to include atrazine-specific data from the study in a scientific advisory panel meeting scheduled for September. The second delay, likely to delay the final word on atrazine, is a discrepancy between how Syngenta and the EPA interpret the details of how atrazine works in the body. The chief executive officer of RCAF USA believes the federal government is conducting its first investigation into whether the handful of large meat packers that slaughter most of the nation's cattle are illegally or unfairly driving down cattle prices. Bill Bullard, the chief executive officer of RCAF USA, says the Federal Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration has been speaking with his group's members for months and is, quote, clearly asking questions in the context of an investigation. The administrator of GPSA would not say whether the agency was investigating the so-called Big Four meat packers, Tyson Foods, JBS, Cargill, and National Beef. But Administrator J. Dooley Butler says GPSA is being more aggressive in enforcing the Packers and Stockyards Act, and investigations are part of that. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report, Commodity Week, and the second half hour of this program, which we do call the Farming World. You can find them all online at willag.org. Now, up next, corn, as we know it today, is a relatively young crop in comparison to the age of the world. All this week, I'll report on the history of corn with retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer. Now, Troyer spent 7 years researching and writing about his favorite crop. Today, we'll explore how corn was domesticated and how it came to the United States. Corn was first domesticated in Mexico between 4,500 and 7,000 years ago along the 18th parallel. It was flint corn. Somewhere around 1,000 BC, retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer says this early corn was moved into the area we now know as New Mexico and Arizona.
And then the dent corn came in after Columbus, probably Cortez, when he went to Tampa Bay, when he went to Tampa Bay, probably brought the first dent corn to the United States.
The critical thing about these two moves was that the corn, flint and dent, had to be adapted to longer days and cooler, shorter seasons. Now, dent has also been developed in Mexico, but much later than flint, probably about 1500 BC, says Troyer. So flint corn came into the southwestern part of the United States, and dent corn traveled much later into the eastern U.S. Dent corn was superior to flint in almost every respect. The kernels were larger and the yields were greater. Soon enough, European settlers in the New World recognized the two different kinds of corn were related and could be crossed.
And the flints were the source of earlier maturity that was needed, and the dents were the source of higher yield and also better feeding traits. So some number of people in Virginia and in Tennessee and Kentucky crossed flint by dents to develop varieties.
Generally, says Troyer, it is estimated that by the time most of the United States had been settled in the 1840s, about 250 different varieties of dent/flint crosses had been developed. The Corn Belt at that time still hadn't made its way northward. The prime growing states were Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
And the reason for that is that the land grants from the Revolutionary War from Virginia, the state of Virginia, and also the land grants that were issued to veterans of the Mexican War were virtually all in that area. There was a small area in southern Ohio on the Scioto River, but there were two areas in Tennessee and there's two areas in Kentucky, and of course the corn in Virginia was already there. I mean, you know that they had already worked with it before the movement west started.
It is the combination of what American Indians did in bringing flint corn north into the U.S. and what European settlers did with dent corn on the East Coast that has resulted in the hybrids grown today by farmers in the new Corn Belt: Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. As farmers settled those states, they brought the 250 dent-flint crosses northwestward with them. Those open pollinated crosses, the dent-flint combinations, were quickly adapted to the growing conditions of the Midwest. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On the line with us this afternoon to take a look at the cash grain market is Matt Payne of the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Well, when I asked, you said you wanted to talk a lot about the marketplace. You must have something in mind, so I'm going to let you start with that. How'd you see the marketplace at this point?
Well, today was kind of a mixed bag. We saw some good rallies last week, kind of gave it back all the way today. One thing that's going to be very interesting right now is basis, especially corn, we feel is really going to improve just because there isn't a whole lot of old crop corn left in the system. Most guys have kind of cleaned out their bins by now. As most everyone knows, the 20 inches of rain that hit central Tennessee has currently closed the river system in that neck of the woods. The Tennessee Tombigbee, Cumberland, and Tennessee rivers are all closed probably up until the 14th due to high water levels and flooding. And that'll definitely hit a crunch in the marketplace, and basis could get a little bit better just because of that, because processors still need corn.
So they'll need corn. Speaking of things that are closing up, what do you hear about New Orleans?
I spoke with some people down there this morning. Right now, the very last port at Mile 45, which is basically the mouth of the river, is still opening and functioning. They're watching it very closely hour by hour, but they have not stopped or slowed traffic right now anyway.
Is there expectation that they could?
There is. There definitely is. There is alternative routes into New Orleans through the intercoastal waterways east and west. Major container ships cannot fit through, though. So rerouting would have to occur either through Mobile or Galveston, Houston.
And when you talk about major container ships, of course, would
stuff that would go to Asia or the Middle East.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of container. Are those the box containers?
Correct.
So would that cause much of a problem with ships that would be hauling grains and oilseeds?
There would, just because of turnaround time. If the ports are closed due to the oil, they'll have to wait outside the mouth of the Mississippi, which will just affect everything.
Okay.
When you stop that turnaround time and the stevedores can't do their job, things just back up.
All right, then come back closer to the home. You talked about the rivers closing because of the rainfall in Tennessee and bases getting better. Why is that the case?
Just because, especially in that area, a lot of movement happens from rail down to that area, and some may get on to barges to go to the Mississippi. In this area, they, with all that rain, they can't get on the barge and go somewhere. So our area, facilities may be hollering for corn, which they may pay up for, coming from farther distance away.
You mean corn coming up the Illinois and the Mississippi rivers?
No, going to them.
Going to them.
Via rail.
All the processors there would need it via rail, and the spurs would come from here, as opposed to the local area, which must be coming in by river. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so we have corn, not much corn that you think that is in the bin. Is most of the old crop corn in storage with you sold, or do producers still have quite a bit left to sell?
I would say there's probably still about 25% to 30% guys are hanging on to, thinking that there still may be weather issue rallies. I think it's going to be a very narrow trade. As we gained some last week, we took a part of it back today. I think it'll be a lot of give and take the next couple weeks.
Would you be, if it were you, would you be a holder through June, if you could?
If you can, I would be. I think just because basis will improve, and I think there's still a little bit more to give in the corn market.
Tell me about the soy complex.
I've been negative for a long time. I still am. I feel that we've seen a really nice rally, and if you haven't taken advantage of it, I think, you know, we could have easily, we lost, you know, 13 today. It could have easily been 30.
All right. Anything else you want to add before I let you go for the
day? No, I think that's all.
What are your bids?
Right now, cash corn, 357, June delivery, 361, fall delivery, 359, and Dees, 369. Beans, cash delivery, 971, June, 976, fall, 926. And December 940.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Payne is with the Andersons. Somebody from that facility right here in Champaign County joins us on the Closing Mark Report each and every Monday afternoon to take a look at the cash grain market. In just 2 minutes, we'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. They're up on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building, and they'll give us a view of what's happening in the world of agricultural weather for the Midwest, the nation, and the globe. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media.
It's National Raspberry Popover Day. The raspberry was a native bush to Turkey, and as early as the 1st century B.C., was gathered from vines at the foothills of Troy. William Prince established the first raspberry plant in nurseries in the American colonies in 1737. and Luther Burbank is credited with introducing a number of raspberry hybrids into American horticulture. On this day in agricultural history in 1654, a bridge in Raleigh, Massachusetts began charging a toll for animals while people passed for free. In 1844, William Atwater was born, an American scientist. He developed agricultural chemistry. After receiving a Ph.D. from Yale for his studies on the chemical makeup of corn, he turned his attention to the effects of fertilizers in farming. Later, he determined the chemical makeup and nutritional values of fish and animals. In 1910, Howard Ricketts died, an American pathologist. He discovered that Rocky Mountain spotted fever is spread by cattle ticks and that typhus was caused.
Good stretch of spring weather that we've been having.
When we talked to our cash grain analysis, they mentioned the 20 inches of rainfall the parts of Tennessee had picked up and the idea that that had done some pretty heavy flooding damage to the river system. What can you tell me about where that rain fell?
Yeah, the heaviest totals, those totals in excess of 10 inches, was primarily confined to areas of central Tennessee. Yes, there is some ag acreage in that area. However, your bigger production counties are actually further west, closer to the Mississippi River. But that has to be watched here. At least those floodwaters will eventually, at least some of them, will flow into the Mississippi River. So the acreage closest to the river systems will likely be impacted the most. But it could have been worse if you had those heaviest totals directly over the heart of the Delta. And in this scenario, this past weekend, that was not the case.
And turn your attention then to the next rain event supposed to come in later this week?
Yeah, primarily on Friday and on into Saturday, we see another widespread significant rain event across the Midwest. And if anything, compared with this past system, we do see at least heavier rains a bit further north. So actually, that includes some of the areas that did not get that much precipitation with this past event. We don't see anything that would result in any kind of big widespread flooding at all, but overall a significant event in some of your higher totals, kind of in that 1 to 2 inch range for totals here, look to be biased further north. And actually some of the areas that could use it that have not at least received that much rain here in recent weeks.
And then finally, if you could tell me about the winds as it concerns the oil spill in the Gulf and how it might spread into environmentally sensitive areas along the coast.
Yeah, we continue to have that oil slick here off of the mouth of the Mississippi River. And over the next few days, the winds look to turn into a westerly direction here, getting into west to east. So that would result in at least a bit more expansion to the east. But not only the wind flow is playing a major role in the circulation, but also just the little currents or eddies in the Gulf of Mexico. That's going to result in at least some kind of spreading out here over time here and continue to keep the issue ongoing probably for many, many weeks.
Mark, thanks much.
My pleasure, Todd.
Mark Russo with Chesapeake Energy. You're listening to the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Farming World news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk about biofuels and relations with Cuba and trade and the renewable fuel standard. Our guest is Alan Kemper. Mr. Kemper's a farmer from Lafayette, Indiana, and currently serves as first vice president or president-elect of the American Soybean Association. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Kemper. How is the farming operation in your area doing this week?
Well, this particular week, we're good. We're halfway through with soybean planting, which is definitely a change up from the 2009 planting season. We actually saw dust this year. Last year, we didn't see dust hardly at all. So, farmers in this area are really optimistic so far.
I think maybe we ought to take a little time and background what you've been up to over the 37 years you've been a farmer, because you have a really wide-ranging look at agriculture under at least three presidents, it appears, and you've been the president of the National Corn Growers Association. You've been past president, of course, of the Indiana Soybean Association. What's your involvement politically been like over the last couple of decades?
Been just representing American agriculture to my best ability over here. Got involved with Indiana Farm Bureau Young Farmers. Became the state chair years ago and big believer in the Indiana Farm Bureau and the various commodity groups, and been just staying active. I think a lot of farmers need to understand their duties and obligations don't end when they dump their product at the elevator or the slaughter plant. For that, they need to stay involved with the various groups, whichever they want to, and work in.
Yeah, and one footnote here, you're also a cattle producer?
Yeah, we background some calves on pastures during the summer times. Yep.
Let's take up the topics at hand. Start with biodiesel. This is a product made from soybeans.
Exactly right. Biodiesel, we have been pushing for. There has been a tax credit, biodiesel tax incentive, for several years now, and last year it expired on December 31st. We lobbied hard to get extended for that deadline. However, Congress, with their push on health care, didn't get it taken care of. So, again, this year, this allows a dollar a gallon for a tax credit for the biodiesel, and it equates to about 25 cents a bushel extra on the farmer's soybeans as they sell them. So we've gone about 112 days now without that tax credit to the biodiesel producers, and we're trying to get that back. We have some good thoughts out of Congress right now. Both the House and the Senate have passed separate bills, and we're trying to get them to be reconciled in the conference committee.
The biodiesel plants in the United States have suffered dramatically from the lack of this tax incentive?
Exactly. On about January 15th, pretty much all biodiesel plants in the U.S. had shut down with that, because basically they were not competitive without that tax credit available to them. And that's unfortunate, because as the president talks about green jobs and rural American, rural economic development, biodiesel and the soybean industry plays huge into that market. So we see it as a win-win, win for the environment, win for rural America with that. And and it's good for the environment.
Would you speculate on the reasons that Congress decided not to take it up and to approve an extension of the tax incentive for biodiesel?
Well, I think basically Speaker Pelosi and both the Senate decided that health care was much more important to their agenda than to rural America. It's biodiesel, and so they pushed it hard. So we're in there. We've been in. We have a what's called a call about biodiesel campaign from the American Soybean Association, asking a lot of farmers and members to call in and action alert on that.
And how do they do that? Do they visit the website and get a phone number for their congressman?
Exactly. Well, they can visit the American Soybean Association website and get key messages as well as the phone numbers for their congressman. Or most of the farmers anymore out here, I will have to admit and I appreciate, are very active with their congresspeople, whether it's congressmen or senators with that. And so a lot of them already have some firsthand knowledge of it. And with that, while we're talking a little bit about biodiesel, I want to mention a little bit about the bioenergy program when you get time.
Okay. We'll come back to that in just a moment. So
okay.
when you go in and visit with them, recently you said that you think you've got some things in the hopper that might put this back into the system. How soon?
Well, every time we call in or every time we make a visit, it seems like they give us a 30-day out ruling. So now we're looking at probably by the end of May. One time it was before the Easter recess. So politics sometimes are fickle, and so it's up to them and their agenda.
Your plants are shut down. Do you think they'll come back up if the dollar incentive is put back in place?
Yes. A lot of them have already started coming back up just with the indication from the Senate and the House that they were getting it reconciled. So we see production starting back up in numerous plants, even in the ones here in Indiana.
In your opinion, why is it important to have a tax incentive for this fledgling industry?
Well, I think the biodiesel industry needs really a multi-year extension. Unfortunately, the last 2 years we've only been single years. Prior to that, we had a three-year extension. It gives stabilization to the biodiesel industry that we have available tax credit there that they can use to produce a domestically grown renewable fuel made from American agriculture.
You wanted to talk a bit about the bioenergy program. What about it?
Well, I think Part of the situation with the biodiesel industry, the biodiesel program, and over the last fall and such, there was a proposed rule by the biodiesel program that said that if you have a biodiesel plant in a county that had over a 50,000 population, they would not qualify for any incentive programs up to $30 million for the industry incentive program. So that meant like the plant at Owensboro, Kentucky, as well as the one in St. Joe, Missouri, didn't qualify. That rule has been changed enough to now allow them to qualify, but there's also one that says, part of that provision says that if a production plant biodiesel such as Louis Dreyfus here at Claypool, Indiana, has over a 51% foreign ownership, they would not qualify. Well, American Soybean Association feels like that's wrong. We appreciate some of the rules has changed, but we need that rule change because we're talking about probably one-third of the equivalent of Indiana soybeans goes through that plant for biodiesel and soy oil. And so consequently, we need that plant also to be able to be qualified because we're talking rural economic development, we're talking jobs, and we're talking a lot of production that goes through that plant.
But if I'm not mistaken, that plant's already been transferred over completely, and it can move from one to the other completely to soybean oil, and it's running 100% at food grade, right, as opposed to biodiesel at this point.
Well, it's capable of running both food grade as well as soy oil for biodiesel. The challenge is that's not really the question. The real question is they should be treated like every other soybean biodiesel plant out here that gets available for that tax incentive to support them and allow them to expand, and they're not. And it's just mainly because they are foreign owned. Now, if you take a look at a lot of other energy plants, including a lot of petroleum, they're foreign owned too. And we give them some very luxurious tax credits and such. So we're just trying to say the Louis Dreyfus plant needs to be treated just the same as other biodiesel plants throughout the Midwest in this country.
All right, move on to the renewable fuel standards. U.S. EPA is working on the RFS. What kind of stake do the soybean producers of the nation have in that?
Well, we're very pleased that they have final rule out that provides and shows that biodiesel has a positive outcome, that it does not reduce, it actually can achieve significant reductions in greenhouse gas compared to petroleum diesel. So that allows the biodiesel program, biodiesel, to qualify underneath the EPA's final rule on renewable fuels, and we very much appreciate that.
Is there a standard by which biodiesel has to be mixed into the U.S. fuel supply for diesel fuel at this point?
I do not know the answer to that. I'd be happy to get back with you on that.
Okay, I think there is through 2012, but after that, if what I'm seeing correct, there's a 1 billion gallon
standard. Yeah, I would suggest to you, as a farmer officer, there's a lot of information that's still on a learning curve with this guy, and I'd be naive not to be able to say that. I don't have all the information.
Let's move on to trade with Cuba. This is something that every time I talk to a representative, a farmer representative, or somebody who works with one of the agricultural industry associations, trade with Cuba is always high on their list. What is your view about trade with Cuba?
American Soybean Association very much supports expanded trade with Cuba. As most people know right now, that the trade with Cuba has, if you're in Cuba and you have to buy, if you want to buy U.S. grain, you actually have to have the cash in advance before that happens, and we want to treat them just like we would treat any other country, similar to China and other countries, and we see it as a big win for American agriculture, not only soybeans, but other products, if we open up the trade with Cuba. It's 90 miles away from Florida. I mean, that's the same distance I am from Champaign, Urbana, and we're restricting them, and we think we need to open that up.
How big a market might it be?
It's significant, and I can't actually quote how big it is right now, but it'd be not near as large as some of the other ones. But
let me take a different tact. What is the stake here? It's significant, but a small amount in the grand scheme of soybean sales. What's the stake for the agricultural industry in opening trade with Cuba?
Well, I think it's sending the final signal that we're very much a free and fair trade agriculture is in the U.S. I mean, it's no different than we have free trade agreements still pending with South Korea, with Panama, and with Colombia that we need to see signed and put through Congress. As we go through this, a lot of the world is into regional trading blocks. This is a market that's right offshore from us, but yet we hinder our products from going there. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, it gets wrapped up very much in the politics and immigration, particularly into the Latin American people and Florida and such. And so, unfortunately, again, American agriculture is second place to another national policy.
Mr. Kemper, do you have a goal once you take the leadership role, the final leadership role as the president of the American Soybean Association? Have you set goals for yourself on what kind of actions you'd like to have take place?
Well, I think it's safe to say that the American Soybean Association is a very first-class policy organization. I want to see that continue, and if not, expand a little bit. We also do a lot in leadership development. We have a 2012 farm bill that we haven't really discussed here this morning that Chairman Pearson I've met with, and Representative Boswell and Senator Lugar and others are getting ready to put in place. As a matter of fact, they're getting ready to have field hearings here in May, and we're wanting to be very much involved over the next 12 months on the farm bill.
You're listening to The Farming World. It's news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, and it's a production of Illinois Public Media. Our guest today is Alan Kemper. He's from Lafayette, Indiana, and serves as the first vice president of the American Soybean Association. More with him when we return.
University of Illinois Extension.
This is Dave Dickey with a look at business news. China has ordered banks to raise the amount of money they hold in reserves for a third time this year in a new effort to dampen inflation pressures in the world's third largest economy. The measure, announced today, comes as the government tries to cool a credit boom without raising interest rates, which might slow China's economic rebound. The People's Bank of China told banks to increase reserves by half a percentage point to 17% of their deposits for large institutions and 14% for most others. China's Vice Minister of Finance today says the increase in bank reserve requirements was aimed at taming liquidity and inflation.
Particularly, it's interesting change in some of the ACRE program, which affects a lot of commodities, and we're going to work with him on that and bring in some county yields. He's also crop insurance is a very large part of agricultural programs. It's not in part of the Farm Bill, but he wants to run it in parallel tracks with it, so we're going to hopefully work with him on some modifications to the crop insurance. Both of these provide an adequate safety net or a safety net for American agriculture, and we're out here to make sure the soybean producers as well as others are protected and make sure they have a safety net. As we visit with Representative Lucas out of Oklahoma, he's considered very much interested in conservation programs, so we'll see that. I think the main message is American Soybean Association has a Farm Bill working group that we put together a few months ago, made up of a diverse group of farmers from all over the country, representing 31 states of production through 29 membership states, to work towards a goal of putting together a Farm Bill position.
The Obama administration, through the Secretary of Agriculture, said at first that it didn't want to really be involved and it was going to let others write the Farm Bill, those who had a vested interest in it. And then last week, in the same process, actually in the same week, came back and said, well, there are some changes we'd really kind of like to think we'd like to look at. Do the changes that they're proposing, and I'm not sure that anybody really has a very good idea, but do the changes that you think they might be proposing seem like good ideas or bad ideas to you?
Well, I think we're considering all of them. We haven't really looked in the detail of a lot of them, but I would just suggest to you that every administration I've worked with over the course of numerous years in Washington, the USDA always has a position on the Farm Bill. And a lot of times they get merged into what Congress wants with that. So it's kind of a give and take as we go through that. I know the Secretary testified about a week and a half ago now in the hearings in front of the chairman and put forward some of their positions. Chairman Pearson is going to be starting field hearings starting, I believe, this week, and I don't know all the locations for that across the country to get some views with it. His intention is to actually come back this fall and do a lot of inside a room type conversations with commodity groups and kind of get their thoughts and then do what we call a markup or actually writing of the bill starting early January, February of next year to try to get finished early spring next year.
Is your preference, and I remember this from President Bush, the second President Bush, that the first time around the administration there didn't really, they took a pretty hands-off look at the Farm Bill, and most of the organizations, I think, did not like that. Eventually, they did release a Farm Bill platform. Is your preference personally that the administration put together some kind of Farm Bill platform and then put that out as a trial and start there, or would you prefer not to have the administration be involved directly with that policy issue?
Well, American Soybean Association really expects that a lot of different entities will put forward positions, no different. The USDA will put forward theirs, and it's been received on the Hill sometimes real well and sometimes it's almost dead on arrival with that. And as I go into the, as you call it, the Beltway or Washington, D.C., like I will be this week for international trade meetings, Congress will make sure that everybody understands that Congress writes the bill. The Senate Ag and the House Ag Committees will write the bill and get their respective houses to pass it, and they will look at most everybody's opinions, and then they will write it. Our job as American soybean farmers is to be in the room or near the room when they're writing it to make sure that the farmers, soybean farmers of America, are protected. Let me add just to that, and we didn't touch on this earlier, but part of our position has been all along is to make sure a lot of us truly believe in the land-grant systems, and we lobby hard for it, for research and extension at the federal level. It's always on our priority statements, usually on the first page.
That was actually my next question in line, was that you stand in the shadow of Purdue University, a land grant there at Lafayette. I'm here located at the land grant in Urbana-Champaign at Illinois. And the American Soybean Association, I'm sure, recognizes that funding from Congress has either stayed steady or dropped over the years for research. Would you like more money to come into those systems?
Well, I think so. I think the land grant universities and the federal dollars have dwindled down, and a lot of times it's not made up at the state level. So consequently, we go in and lobby for more research, sometimes more targeted research, like into genomics and new uses and those type of things. So, but we also need just the really basic research out here. It's awful easy for industry to do the real fancy research, but the basic research that the farmers and agriculture still needs has to be done at the land grants, and we support that.
Mr. Kemper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you much.
Alan Kemper is a Lafayette, Indiana farmer and first vice president of the American Soybean Association. You've been listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.